In the 2024 Jeep Grand Cherokee L, the journey from point A to point B isn't such a rush. In fact, with three rows of spacious comfort, thoughtfully crafted luxurious design, and an available premium Macintosh audio system, you'll find yourself seeking out the scenic route more often, even if it's just another lap around the block. Jeep, there's only one. Visit Jeep.com to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
This episode is brought to you by Ollie. Back to school means food changes. Early breakfasts, school lunches, after-school snacks, and let's not even talk about dinner. Ollie's here to help you cover all the wellness bases, from daily multivitamins to belly-balancing probiotics. Ollie's got your fam covered. Buy three and get one free with code BUNDLE24 at OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to Inside Politics. I'm Dana Bash, live from the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee, where tonight a new heir to the MAGA movement will step into the spotlight. J.D. Vance will introduce himself to the nation and, frankly, the world on the stage that is right behind me. We are told Donald Trump's running mate will focus heavily on his personal story, rising up from a poor, unstable family that struggled with addiction in rural Ohio to becoming a graduate of Yale Law School, and a Marine, a venture capitalist, and of course, a best-selling author, and now a United States Senator. A source tells CNN the vice presidential pick will be introduced by his wife, Usha Vance, who he credits as a key part of his success. I also have new reporting about a very tense call between President Biden and a group of centrist House Democrats on Saturday, where President Biden told a Democratic lawmaker to cut that crap out after the congressman told the president that voters are losing confidence in him. Much more on that ahead. And there is so much to discuss with our great reporters who are here in Milwaukee, CNN's Phil Mattingly, Nia Malika Henderson of CNN and Bloomberg, CNN's Jeff Zeleny, and The Washington Post's Leanne Caldwell. Hi, everybody. So let's look ahead to tonight and to the J.D. Vance moment that we are going to see. Jeff Zeleny, what are you hearing from your sources about what to expect, and more importantly, the kind of persona and message that the campaign hopes that the American people will see and hear from him?
Look, most people in the hall know who Senator J.D. Vance is, even though he was elected less than 2 years ago. But the country does not. So this is that opportunity. So we're going to hear a bit of a hillbilly elegy. Of course, that's his best-selling memoir. But also going to be what I'm watching for is really how much of that MAGA movement and the Trump brand he extends to. I mean, he is here now with a new job. That is to defend, that is to protect, and sort of argue for Donald Trump. So he's not promoting himself necessarily. So I think it's always interesting to see a running mate, that evolution. I've been watching them in the convention hall, as we all have the last couple days, seeing how they're sort of settling into their new role. They've not known each other very long, and it started off on the wrong foot, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
So I think that is something that I'll be watching for as well. But you mentioned Usha. She is introducing him, but she's also introducing herself. Her story is fascinating. She was a law school graduate with him. She worked for the Chief Justice, John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh, when he was on the Court of Appeals. So amazingly accomplished in her own right. So this is an introduction of both of them, but it's still about Donald Trump. This is his show, and J.D. Vance is just a key player in it.
So Senator Vance, for the past couple of years in the Senate, has been a really fascinating figure to watch. He came in there. One of the first actions he did is he tried to get bipartisan legislation with Senator Sherrod Brown, who is now in his own Senate reelection race, about the train derailment in Ohio. He was quickly shut down by some of his Republicans in his conference because of that first bipartisan push. Now, though, the reason that is so fascinating is because that was that economic strain of the Republican Party of why he was pushing that, not necessarily because of the bipartisanship, but he had Democratic allies there on this populist component of what he wanted to accomplish. So I'm really looking tonight to see how much of that comes through, if at all, and also the isolationist component of J.D. Vance regarding Ukraine.
Well, because you brought that up, let's talk about that. Because in my experience talking to Republicans here, especially some of the more traditional Republicans, not in the populist Trump strain of the party, there's concern about J.D. Vance, not necessarily being the vice president if Donald Trump wins, because it's Donald Trump's foreign policy, but if he does, in fact, become the next leader of the MAGA movement, because he is so incredibly different from traditional Republicans when it comes to national security. Ukraine is the prime example. Let's just listen to J.D. Vance on with Jake Tapper on April 14th talking about Ukraine.
We cannot possibly support Ukraine and Israel and our own defense needs in the way that these guys demand. So I think we should focus. I think Israel is a much closer ally, is a much more core American national security interest. And of course, we've got to focus on ourselves.
I mean, Phil, that I'm sure you're hearing the same thing. Yeah. That is really upsetting some of the more hawkish Republicans who believe that it is America's role to do just that. It's not just about Ukraine. They say it's about democracy in general.
And I think it further underscores, and look, we've been covering this for now 8, 9, 10 years at this point, the shift in the Republican Party. That is now, if you're looking for a short-term kind of area of unsettlement for Republicans right now, they're not going to say it publicly, very supportive of J.D. Vance. You talk to senators who maybe don't like J.D. Vance a whole lot back in Washington, not because they have personal issues with him, but just because they disagree vehemently on certain policy issues. They will tell you they're very excited and they think this is a really great idea. On the near term, I think on a national security level, when you talk to Republicans, it is the issue of Ukraine. It is the issue of what has long been GOP orthodoxy in terms of the United States' role in the world. And they will point directly to Ronald Reagan and much further back as to why kind of closing your shores or closing the doors to your country is hugely problematic, and they don't feel like Vance is in any way matching that strain. And it's not that he's going to take over the administration's foreign policy. The concern is based on the fact that they know Trump vacillates on this. They know there are camps within Trump's national security kind of infrastructure or apparatus around him that have wars over this very topic. And so what his voice does now being added to that inside the Situation Room, inside the Oval Office, they're having conversations, I think that concerns people longer term. I think this has been a recognition that for anybody who was still grasping onto a thread that the Republican Party would go back to Reagan or back to Bush or back to Romney in terms of where they are on not just national security policy, but also economic policy. Vance is making clear that's not going to happen. It's just going down this path. And those folks, the Mitch McConnells of the world, the Dan Sullivans of the world, they're not in that lane anymore.
Yeah. Nia, I want you to listen and our viewers to listen to what Kamala Harris had to say this morning about the man that she will likely debate.
Trump looked for someone he knew would be a rubber stamp for his extreme agenda. And make no mistake, J.D. Vance will be loyal only to Trump, not to our country. Vance said he would have carried out Trump's plan to overturn the 2020 election. He supports a national abortion ban and voted against protecting IVF.
That's a debate that I'm really looking forward to.
This
between
is going to
two
be
a, very smart lawyers and politicians.
It's going to be a much-watched debate. And tonight, J.D. Vance is going to have to answer some of these charges that Democrats are happy to level at him, that he's a radical, that he's an extremist. I think the job tonight, he's obviously speaking to Americans who don't really know much about him. The fact that his wife is introducing him, I think it gives them a chance to soften him, right, to humanize him, to talk about his from Appalachia to the Senate, a story which is compelling to a lot of folks. You know, I think if you're Republicans, you do see some room for him to grow, perhaps among suburban women, certainly among working class white voters, right? This sort of economic populism message that he will bring. You know, he's certainly going to be trying to do that tonight. We saw some of that obviously already with Donald Trump and trying to soften him last night. I think that's going to be the goal tonight with J.D. Vance.
Okay, so there are two. I'm glad you brought that up. Gosh, it's like you guys know exactly where we're going with this conversation. There are two points I want to make about expanding who is going to vote for Donald Trump and about the softening that we saw last night. Let's start with Nikki Haley and what she said when she came out on the stage behind us.
My message to them is simple. You don't have to agree with Trump 100% of the time to vote for him. Take it from me, I haven't always agreed with President Trump. But we agree more often than we disagree.
Okay, so that was her message to the people who voted for her, including the tens of thousands of people who voted for her after she dropped out of the race. And I want to just give an example of the swing state where we're sitting right now, Wisconsin. Nikki Haley got 76,841 votes in that primary. What she said last night was, please, voters, go and support Donald Trump. Just look at how important that message is if you look at 2020 and 2016. Biden's margin of victory here in Wisconsin was a little more than 20,000 votes. Trump's in 2016 was 22,000 votes. And you see also on the left side of your screen, Pennsylvania, she got even more, 158,000 and change. And the margin of victory was much less than half of that in 2020 and even narrower in 2016. So that kind of message, if people who voted for her are listening, is crucial for Donald Trump in these states.
Without question. And we could drive just a few miles from here, the WOW counties right around Milwaukee County, Washington, Waukesha, and Ozaukee. Those are the three counties where the margins really matter. So I was actually talking with a Nikki Haley admirer who lives in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, just about 30 miles from here last night. We were texting. She loves Nikki Haley. She wishes she would have been the choice, but she's voting for Donald Trump because that's what topology she believed in. But I think the bigger point here, that message there is going to be, it didn't necessarily ring out in the hall as much. Yeah, right. That is going to be in ads that super PACs and others place to suburban voters to try and get them to come along.
Yeah, can I just jump off that real quick? Yeah. First off, the Ozaukee comes in the middle, Jeff. You wow, W-O-W. Yeah. Right? Just like, yeah. It was impressive recall. I want them in order. the reason we know a lot about kind of where Haley voters are in the state is because of the great reporting Jeff's been doing here on the ground. And he makes a really great point. I was on the floor during the speech, and the delegates themselves were like kind of ambivalent. Mm-hmm. There were some boos. A lot of them weren't really sure what to do with it. But I think they would recognize as the speech kind of rolled out, she was setting up lines where she would say something like, well, I haven't always supported him or agreed to him. People kind of chuckle and be a little bit awkward, and then kind of drives home the point of like, but this is why we have to. This is why we have to come together. This is why Republicans have to unite. This is why the party has to get bigger. It was less a message for the people that were on the floor who really didn't know what to do with it, and more a message for both the audience last night and also those ads that will be cut.
I want to go back to what you were saying earlier, Nia, about the speeches that we heard last night from women, young women, who in one case worked for him and is now the governor of a state, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and his daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. And it was very clearly aimed at, you said, softening the edges, presenting a different perspective of Donald Trump, specifically when it comes to how he treats women.
Exactly.
But our president pulled me aside, looked me in the eye and said, Sarah, you're smart, you're beautiful, you're tough, and they attack you because you're good at your job.
I come to you as a mom and as a citizen of this country. For those of you watching who have never voted for Donald Trump, I am proud to know Donald Trump, to campaign for him, to vote for him, and to raise his grandchildren.
Yeah, listen, I thought Laura Trump went on for a very long time. I think it was like a 20-minute speech. But it was effective, right? And this is about women. This is about softening. I thought Sarah Huckabee Sanders was much more effective. You know, she was the Southern storyteller up there. There was some sugar in it. And there was, you know, some spice and some heat as well. And the story she was telling was very specific to her, right? People made fun of her specifically because of how she looked. And her, you know, getting that affirmation from Donald Trump was important to her personally. I will say this, though. Donald Trump has said terrible things about women publicly. He may be very nice to the people who are on his payroll and who he is the boss of, but that doesn't really matter, right? He is a public servant. So his behavior and treatment of women publicly, I think, is much more impactful and meaningful for women. And also his policy, right? You know, you can be nice to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but if you're taking the rights of women away all across the country in states like Mississippi and Arkansas because of what the Supreme Court did, that's what suburban women really care about, not that he's a great grandpa.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Obviously, as you said, it's trying to give another perspective based on the fact that a lot of women have heard some of the things that he said. The issues, that's a whole different question. They don't agree on those issues either. But coming up, cut that crap out. That is what Joe Biden told a House Democrat who gave him a blunt assessment of voters' concerns. It's part of my new reporting, which we'll bring you next.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast.
The biggest risk is the fact that the ketamine treatment is associated with an altered state of thinking.
How ketamine so quickly became such a booming business. Some experts are now calling it the Wild West of therapy. What does that mean for people who are seeking out treatment? Listen to Chasing Life, streaming now, wherever you get your podcasts.
We have new reporting into CNN this hour showing just how tense things have gotten between a defiant Joe Biden and key members of his party. Sources tell me that the president lashed out at Congressman Jason Crow in a Saturday call with House Democrats. That happened after the Colorado moderate relayed voters' concerns about the president's vigor and strength, especially when it comes to the world stage. Biden, I'm told, got so upset with Crow's blunt assessment that at one point he said, quote, cut that crap out, and told Crow he could walk away if he wants. My friends and colleagues are back here. Just going to give you a little bit more of information from this call. Some of it had been previously been reported, but I'm getting new details. Leanne, what Jason Crow said to the president in this call was, Americans want a commander-in-chief who can project strength, vigor, and inspire confidence at home and abroad. They need to feel that you have the helm when they go to bed each night. Despite your many successes and the dangers of Trump, we are seeing overwhelming evidence in our districts that many voters are losing confidence you can do this in a second term. It's not fair, but it's true. Very, very blunt and very direct. Yeah. And here is what I'm told happened after that. I'm told the president responded to Crow, an Army Ranger, we should note, who served two tours in Afghanistan and one in Iraq, that he knows Crow is a Bronze Star recipient, like Biden's son Beau, but that he didn't rebuild NATO, meaning Crow. According to two sources familiar with the call, the exchange got even more contentious when Crow pushed back on the president, who also argued that NATO leaders are supportive of him. Now, Crow told the president that he needs to understand that voters aren't seeing him that way. At one point, Biden told Crow to cut that crap out, and that if Crow wants to walk away from him, then he can walk away.
Yeah. So that call happened Saturday, as you mentioned. It's with a new Democratic coalition where many of those members are frontline members. Those are the ones who represent swing states. They call themselves the majority makers of the Democratic Party. And the readout I got of that call is that it was intense, that Biden, quote, screamed at Crow, and that it was absolutely a disaster, that these members had been extremely concerned that President Biden is not hearing what he needs to hear, that his small circle of people are keeping him so separated from what the Democratic Party elected officials, donors, and voters think, that this was their opportunity to tell the president that directly. And as you reported, Dana, it did not go over very well. And we see that the president is still entrenched and sticking in. And so is the campaign is behind him and his team. But there's still, this is not going away. A lot of the attention is on this Republican convention. And there is still so much frustration and nervousness among Democrats.
And that's really the key. Things did quiet down publicly because of the tragedy that happened on Saturday. I don't think it was that long after this call happened.
Yeah.
Right.
But it is still festering in a very big way. One other example, Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, She used to be a frontliner. Her seat is a little bit safer now, but she represents Bucks County, one of those critical collar counties around Philadelphia. And I'm told that she told the president that he is not doing well in Bucks County and he needs Bucks County in order to win Pennsylvania. He pushed back on her polling and he said that he would get his staff to give her some talking points about how much he's done for Pennsylvania.
And members of Congress, Democrats in these districts, don't want talking points. They want the president to understand the position that they see him and the party in. And there's this strain of consistency. Tomorrow is the third week of this, which is extraordinary. Is he getting the message? That has been one central concern as I talk to senators, members of Congress. So they're speaking out directly to him because they're afraid that he's in an information bubble, that he's not sort of seeing these polls. I'm told that Speaker Pelosi has had similar conversations with him. But as you report on Saturday, what also happened Saturday, which sort of got overtaken by that horrific shooting, was Senator Chuck Schumer, who rarely leaves Brooklyn on Saturdays. He went to a Rehoboth where the president was for the weekend and had a very candid and frank conversation with him. And then the president went to mass and the shooting happened. So that is still sort of yet to play out. So the time is running out a little bit, but the DNC is also now pledged to not start roll call voting until at least August 1st. So there are probably a couple more weeks, but boy, that would be a messy process
as well.
Can I
just, Dana, just back to the core of your reporting. We know who Jason Crow is. We've all covered him since he came to Congress. He was a frontliner in Colorado in the 2018 class that were the majority makers. I think people need to understand that he is not a hyperbolic show horse type. In fact, the day after the debate, I interviewed Jason Crow on CNN, and he aggressively defended President Biden over and over and over again and got fairly frustrated with the questions, which is not his usual way of doing things. The fact this is him, the fact that it's happening behind the scenes, the fact that within the Democratic caucus, he is a leader and he's looked towards, particularly after his actions on January 6th, and he's a leader of a core group inside that caucus. Yes, new Dems, but kind of a broader group of younger members. His willingness to do this, say this, and have this back and forth should send massive alarm bells inside the White House. I don't think he minds having a back and forth with President Biden. I guarantee you he didn't take any offense to it, but it was the tone that he was taking and how he was approaching this after what he'd done publicly and because of where he stands in the caucus that I think underscores that not only is this not going away, it seems to be growing as a problem.
Yeah, I mean, he's, and I should say, just to give a little bit more information, Crow is a former Army Ranger. He served two tours in Afghanistan, one in Iraq. He was a frontliner. Again, he has
not as much anymore.
He has a bit of a safer.
Deeply respected in the caucus.
Very much so. Very much so. And my understanding is that the comment about Crow's Bronze Star was not taken. Was taken as kind of maligning of his service, which I'm sure that's not what President Biden intended, but that apparently.
Yeah, I mean, this is getting really personal. And, you know, obviously we've covered the president. He can he can have a bit of a temper, and it certainly flashed in that conversation. The problem that Biden has is that he has gone out for the last 3 weeks to try to turn the narrative around, to say that the debate was just a one-off, that he is in fact strong and vigorous and was just having a bad night. He just had a cold and he was tired. The problem is his appearances so far since then have been hit or miss. There have been some relatively strong appearances. The news conference was fine, even though he had some gaffes. But still, he's making gaffes. He's still talking in a low voice. He still seems kind of infirm, in fact, when he walks and greets voters. I think he was out in Las Vegas greeting some voters after that very strong NAACP speech. And that's what voters are seeing. And that is what they're telling folks in their districts, these Congress folks who are complaining to the president, some complaining to Nancy Pelosi as well. So it's not going away because a lot of what we see of Biden still just affirms what folks saw in that debate.
Yeah, and so you mentioned this, I think you all have mentioned, that this does speak to one of the very big frustrations and one of the reasons why these members wanted a direct line to the president is that these members whose jobs are on the line and the majorities are on the line and the Democratic policies are on the line are that the president is maybe not getting the message. Okay, everybody stand by. We are coming up going to return the conversation to right where we are here in Milwaukee. Republicans say they are going to win big time. Well, let's dig in more into that question I'm going to talk to Donald Trump's pollster about what he sees that's making his party so confident. Stay with us. Political parties always project confidence during conventions, but this time feels a bit different for Republicans.
The battleground state of Minnesota, which will elect a Republican for president for the first time since 1972.
We're proud to be part of the so-called blue wall, and we're going to tear down that wall.
We believe that President Donald J. Trump will be the first Republican in a generation who will win New York State.
So where is that confidence coming from? Is it talking points? Is it more? Is there data to back it up? Well, former President Donald Trump's pollster, John McLaughlin, is here with me to talk about it. Nice to see you in person.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm going to talk about the map in a second, but I just want to start with where we are, particularly given the horrible events of Saturday. It was already a margin of error race before that, nationally. Obviously, that's not how presidents are elected. But when it comes to the data that you're seeing, has anything changed dramatically since the weekend?
Since the weekend, it's too early to tell. But, you know, with the convention's going very well. For me as a Republican and working for President Trump, it's a totally new territory because we're going into this election with like 111 days left, and we're leading. We're leading in the battleground states. We're leading in the national polls. We never saw that in 2016. It was always an electoral state win that we were playing for, and we were going to lose the national popular vote. But we've been ahead in the national popular vote going back to September 21 when inflation kicked in and President Biden withdrew or surrendered Afghanistan.
Is there such a thing as peaking too early?
No. And we always run in the Trump campaign, we run like with 10 points behind. So we try to work harder, and we know that we've got a lot of work to do, particularly where you have states that start voting in September. A lot of states are voting in October. So the whole Republican Party's basically changed their outlook where we have to get, you know, Trump voters this time, instead of waiting for Election Day, first day we have early voting, you got to get online.
And is he on board with that? Because he wasn't necessarily a pro early voting, as you remember, in 2020. In fact, he was doing the opposite, and a lot of Republicans were pulling their hair out.
Well, I think a lot of it was the drop boxes and the mail-in absentees, but that's gone with COVID. So now every state has their own rules. We're playing by the rules, and we're trying to win every state as they come along.
Okay, so let's talk about the states. Mm-hmm. And you just heard coming in the people who were putting their votes into the roll call earlier this week here from states that are not on the core battleground map. Mm-hmm. Minnesota, Virginia, New Jersey, my home state.
Yes.
How real do you think that is?
It's very real. I mean, the Trump campaign.
And let me just say, for our viewers who aren't intimately involved with the history of these states, Minnesota has been blue, but people like our Jeff Zeleny call it the reddest blue state. Virginia was red, but it has been blue the past few cycles, and New Jersey has been blue for a generation.
Right. And when you look at those states, Minnesota, the Trump campaign rarely releases our polls, but they released a poll we did in mid-June where we were up 4 points in Minnesota. That's with Kennedy in it. Now, in New Jersey, you know, you've seen polls, there's been published polls that were up a point. And you saw the turnout in Wildwood. I mean, people who then when you look at Virginia, and I've polled there over the years for Senator Allen and Governor Gilmore, et cetera, we're back to where we're getting like a fifth of the African-American vote. We're winning where the military is in Norfolk because they're tired of a weak America. So President Trump, there was a VCU poll came out, had us ahead in Virginia. So, and there's other states coming in play. So the map is getting much larger.
Well, let me ask you just real quick, and I do want to get to what we're going to see tonight with the former president's running mate, because you mentioned the African-American vote. Susie Wiles, who is running the Trump campaign, told this to Tim Alberta. It was about black men. It's so targeted. We're not fighting for black people, she said. We're fighting for black men between 18 and 34. Now, let me just give our viewers another bit of context here. In 2020, Biden won black men by 60 points.
Right.
And black voters overall, 18 to 29, by 79 points. Right. Is that realistic?
Yes. It, like, it, we won, and we're getting some black women, too. It's like we're equal opportunity. But we only got 8% in 2016. We got 12% in 2020. And now you're seeing Joe Biden, where a third of the African-American voters disapprove of the job he's doing. And in that, Donald Trump is drafting up, where all of a sudden, you saw what happened when we went to the Bronx. You saw the outreach that we're having, the crowds we're getting in Georgia. He's going to Michigan again. You saw the reception he got in Michigan. We're getting like a fifth of the black vote. Now, the last national poll, we had 21% of African Americans.
We're out of time, but you think Vance is actually a pick that's going to help him electorally?
Yes, it'll help in the Rust Belt states, particularly when you're looking at Michigan and you're looking at Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. He's a veteran. He's young. He's a convert. He's working class, too. He fits. It's definitely going to help. It's like when Clinton picked Gore. It definitely reinforced the brand, and it's definitely going to help us.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Appreciate it. And up next, a Florida congresswoman calls on Latino voters to help usher Donald Trump back into the White House for another term. Florida Representative Maria Elvira Salazar will be here live next.
Comedy is coming to CNN. What could go wrong? Have I got news for you? A comedy quiz show hosted by Roy Wood Jr. with Amber Ruffin and Michael Ian Black premieres Saturday, September 14th at 9 on CNN.
Where are the Venezuelans? Where are the Colombians? The Central Americans? Where are the Cubans? I would like to send a message to the Hispanic community across the country. You are welcomed in the Republican Party. We have the same beliefs. We have the same values.
That was Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar at a Trump rally this month, encouraging undecided Latino voters to join the GOP. She is a daughter of Cuban exiles and says it's time for that key voting bloc to use its growing numbers to help Donald Trump win the White House. And she is here with me now. Thanks for being here.
My
Appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I just want to show our viewers what happened in the last election with the Latino voting bloc. Joe Biden got 65%. Donald Trump got 32%. What makes you think that it is going to be different this time around?
The American dream. The average Hispanic comes to this country because they want to live the American dream. Look on my parents. I am the American dream. I was born in Miami 5 months after they came from escaping the Cuban Revolution. I have become a United States Congresswoman in one generation. Look at me and look at my accent, because everything is possible in this country. So that's exactly what the Hispanics want. They want to be able to buy a house, low interest rates, be able to have affordable food, be able to have cheap gas and open their little cafeteria or the little florist shop and live the American dream. Right now, that's impossible for them to do.
You said that the assassination attempt of Donald Trump is going to help him in the Latino community. Can you explain that?
Well, I'm not sure about the Latino community is going to help him all across America, because after what happened to him, I have good friends close to the president that they have assured me that he is a different man. And you would be a different person if you go through the experience you went through Saturday. He is more contemplative. I'm not going to say spiritual or religious, because we don't know that, but we do know that his character has changed internally. And he, God Almighty, I have no doubt, has given him a second opportunity at life and at leadership. And he is going to use it for the benefit of the country.
And do you think that that's going to change, genuinely change, the way that he either behaves on social media or in public, or more importantly, if he wins again, will it affect his policy?
All of the above.
How so?
All of the above.
You think he's
because
change
when you
policies?
Are a different person, then you look at life in a different way.
How do you want him to change?
Well, I just want him to be the president for all the Americans. And right now, that's the case. Because unfortunately, President Biden, because of his mental fragility, because of everything we're seeing after the debate, the average American is looking at a figure that to give them guidance. And right now, it's President Trump. And the polls indicate it.
I want to ask you about President Biden. And specifically on the issue of immigration and the executive order, one of the executive orders that he signed recently. And the one that I want to ask you about allowed some undocumented spouses and children of U.S. citizens to apply for lawful citizenship, permanent residency, I should say, not citizenship, without leaving the country, which means protections for about 500,000 American families, roughly 50,000 non-citizen children of immigrants.
Don't start me on immigration because you know that's
but
my
what about,
lane.
I know,
I'll
but
tell you,
specific.
It's too little, too late. I'm going to explain to you why. The Democratic Party has had the biggest opportunity for the last 30 years to give some type of response to those people who have been here illegally. And you know, I wrote the Dignity Act, which is the only immigration reform law on the books right now in Congress, because I want to give dignity to those people who have been here for more than 5 years. The Dems had, during Obama and during Biden, the possibility to pass immigration reform law and give dignity to our people. And they didn't.
Well, I mean, I was there. I was in the hallways.
Uh-huh.
This was blown up in large part because the Republican base didn't want it. They were so close so many times.
During Obama, we were at this interview when he told us in 2008 that in the first 100 days of his presidency, he was going to sign an immigration reform law. And he invested that political capital in Obamacare. That was a lie. Now let's move forward 2020. President Biden, he said, I'm going to give an immigration reform law to everyone who votes for me in our community within the first 100 days.
And it was blown up by Donald Trump, who told the Republicans not
really, because,
not to sign
because
it.
Because the Dems had, under Nancy Pelosi, the Dems had Congress and they had Senate and they had and everything passed. BBB was considered, the infrastructure, the $1.9 trillion. Immigration is unfortunately, immigration is not a top priority, even though they say it is.
It's also, I mean, it is impossible when it comes to these issues in Congress right now, which is
but
why.
But the Dems could have done it. They could have done it 30 years ago, 20 years ago, under Biden. And that's why I wrote the Dignity Law.
Well, I was covering Congress then, and they tried, and it fell apart for lots of reasons, primarily because
Nancy never introduced an immigration reform law the first 2 years of Biden.
My last thing, and I have to go to break, is specifically about this executive order. There are people for whom their lives changed overnight.
And I agree with it. But I agree with that. And I agree bringing out of the shadows all those millions of people who are helping the economy and don't have any papers, the DACA, the Dreamers. Oh, there's an array of people besides the other spouses.
But you come back, we'll talk more about it.
I'm here delightfully. Okay. Give me half an hour and then we can have a great conversation.
Okay, nice to see you.
Wonderful.
Thank you. And coming up, a hairy political issue. I'm talking about J.D. Vance's beard, of course, how it could have made history and it could make history in the White House. We got to have a little fun here. Tonight, J.D. Vance will introduce himself to the American people. We are told Donald Trump's VP pick will focus on his upbringing. And here at Inside Politics, we have talked a lot about his policy positions. But now I want to get to something really important: facial hair. If Trump wins in November, the Ohio senator would become the first vice president in nearly a century to wear facial hair. The last was Charles Curtis, Herbert Hoover's vice president from 1929 to 1933, who, as you can see, had a nice-looking mustache. Donald Trump is known to prefer a clean-shaven look, but when asked about the beard, J.D. Vance's beard last week, he said he looks good. He looks like a young Abraham Lincoln. Now, facial hair aside, we want to highlight something else on J.D. Vance's resume.
Also with us, CNN contributor J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis.
Joining me now to talk more about this is CNN contributor J.D. Vance.
CNN contributor J.D. Vance.
That's right. J.D. Vance was a former, or is a former CNN contributor. He is now on the presidential ticket. That is a first. He used a razor back then. Thank you so much for joining Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after the break.